Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, it's hard to believe, but it's already been a year since Prop 47 became law. That's the voter-approved proposition that changed many drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Both sides claimed the measure would have markedly different effects, with supporters saying it would give nonviolent offenders a new lease on life, while opponents said it would cause crime to spike. So what's actually happening, and how are counties here in the Valley dealing with it? We'll talk to Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez, who sits on the state board responsible for corrections. That's coming up later in our show. But first, you can't talk about law enforcement and corrections without also discussing the state budget. Last week, Governor Brown introduced his budget proposal for the next fiscal year with a press conference at the state capitol. He waved charts and warned of a looming recession, even as he called for new taxes and the largest budget of his political career. But as Ben Bradford reports from Sacramento, he stuck to a familiar theme of fiscal restraint.
It's become a common sight at Governor Brown's annual budget proposal, and this one was no different.
Everybody thinks when they're up here, it's all wonderful.
Brown taps the high point on a poster-sized chart showing cycles of economic boom and bust. He also holds them over his head.
That's what they thought before the dot-com, and that's what they thought before the mortgage meltdown, both of those. And so here we are again.
The budget projects $8 billion more revenue to work with than was spent last year. But the governor cautioned against growing government programs.
We've had 10 recessions since World War II. We know we'll get another recession, but nobody ever plans for it. So it's always a surprise. Oh, my gosh.
Brown would keep a budget surplus, pay down debt, and put $2 billion more than required into the state's rainy day fund. One Republican lawmaker called that not terrible. Senate Budget Committee Vice Chair Jim Nielsen was more effusive.
2 years in a row, we're very happy. The governor is encouraging his Democratic colleagues be restrained.
It's fellow Democrats Brown has clashed with most fiercely during past negotiations. But this year's budget has some long-sought increases. That includes billions of dollars for education, doubling of the cap and trade funds dedicated to affordable housing, and over $1 billion to fix rundown state buildings. It also adds hundreds of millions for drought and wildfires. Assembly Budget Committee Chair Shirley Weber says it's better than past years.
This is a good place to start the conversation, and it's not the end of the conversation, but at least it starts in a better place than we felt we've started in the past.
The debate on what should change began immediately.
Where do I begin?
Republican lawmakers called for using the surplus to fund services for the developmentally disabled, while Democratic leaders also added early childhood education and housing for the homeless. Community college faculty called for more money. Samantha Contreras of SEIU says the budget leaves in-home caretakers and their patients in limbo.
These are people that are living with autism, quadriplegics. Like, these are people that need serious care.
Brown calls for retaining funding for in-home caretakers, but it's only if lawmakers agree to broaden a tax on managed health care plans. The legislature has spent the year deadlocked on whether to extend the tax, which would require Republican votes. Republican Senate Leader Gene Fuller doesn't see that dynamic changing.
We do believe that when there is an unanticipated budget income of the amounts that we're seeing, that there is no need for additional new taxes.
Similarly, Republicans continue to oppose raising the gas tax, while Brown continues to call for using it to pay for road repairs and upgrades. The governor says he'll keep lobbying, but acknowledged the stalemate.
At the end of the day, there are views of the world, and they are different. And that's the way it is.
Ultimately, as both policy and politics, this budget largely stays the course Brown has charted in the past. It puts more money towards priorities, climate change and drought. It grows education, but few other social services. And it leaves lawmakers in both parties wanting more. Standard, says Assembly Speaker Tony Atkins.
We have to have dance steps. He has some, we have some. It's how we do it together.
It's now the legislature's turn to take the lead. Senate and Assembly committees will begin working up their own versions of the budget en route to the legislature's June 15th constitutional deadline. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Bradford.
This is Valley Edition. Forget R2-D2 and C-3PO. Sorry, Star Wars fans. Intelligent, human-like robots are already a reality. In fact, they were some of the big hits of this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. They've even made their way to Fresno. Reporter Carrie Klein brings us this story about an event this past weekend where local kids got to play with some very smart robots.
It's Sunday morning in downtown Fresno, and a classroom full of 10-year-olds is about to meet an important visitor.
Hello, my name is Nao.
Nao is a little red and white robot. He stands about 2 feet tall and looks like a mix between a Transformer and a Power Ranger. Big head, square shoulders, and what looks like thick gloves and boots. He can wave his arms, walk, dance, and blink his eyes, just like a tiny human.
I can recognize your face, answer your questions, and even play soccer like a pro.
Nao was designed to be an interactive companion for people. He's completely programmable, from the faces he recognizes to what he says and how he moves. And he's equipped with a library of emotions. When he's disappointed, he lowers his eyes and shakes his head. Victory is a fist pump. He can even crouch down and cackle with glee. But Nao isn't in Fresno to show off. He's here as part of a tech workshop to teach kids how they can develop and use advanced robots.
The thing for us is to show them that they don't have to be just users of technology, that they can also be creators and build things.
Nicolas Rigaud works for Aldebaran Robotics, the Japanese-owned French company that created Nao. He brought the robot to Fresno on the way home from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, one of the biggest tech conventions in the world. He says he wants to demonstrate creative ways of interacting with technology.
So we have this sentence, which is, your kids play game, mine makes them. And that's really the whole idea for us.
This is the first time kids in Fresno have had access to such advanced humanoid robots that can be programmed to hold conversations and share emotions. The workshop is taking place at GeekWise Academy, the educational arm of local tech company Bitwise. Here, a half dozen fifth graders and their parents are gathered in a basement classroom with laptops. Their task? Write a story for the robot to act out.
One of the things that is important is that the robot is not just going to tell a story, but he's also going to express emotions with his body.
The students begin by learning how to use basic programming software. Within minutes, they start to string together multiple commands, like say this phrase, look excited, and do a little dance. Most of their stories are about parties and friendship, and involve a fist pump or two.
I met lots of friends. They made me so happy.
Riley Prindeville of Fairmont School in Sanger really likes robots. She's counting down the months until she can join a robotics team at school. This workshop, thumbs up.
Yeah, I loved it. Because it's just really interesting to be able to interact with the robot.
For Carruthers Elementary schooler Sebastian Lopez Solis, the joy is in writing his story about the robot slaying dragons.
I thought it was really cool to see the robot dance and basically tell stories.
Chaba Toth is a local software developer who organized the event. He met Rigaud at a conference a few months ago and invited him to Fresno. Originally, he wanted Rigaud to speak to other developers, but then he realized the potential for kids.
Now I'm so happy to saw how kids were excited. I'm really happy that this came together.
He says he'll be inviting Aldebaran Robotics and other tech developers back for more events later on this year. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's been 1 year since Proposition 47, the voter-approved law that has recategorized certain drug-related and petty theft crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, went into effect. The change also let people previously convicted of these crimes remove felonies from their records. Some in law enforcement say it's led to an uptick in certain crimes, while others disagree. Our next guest has a unique perspective on Proposition 47 and the larger issue of criminal justice in California. She is Leticia Perez, a Kern County supervisor and a member of the Board of State and Community Corrections, which is charged with dealing with a lot of issues in regards to corrections and rehabilitation in the state. Supervisor Perez, welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's been 1 year since Prop 47 went into effect now. From your perspective, how is this experiment going so far?
Well, as you know, a year is very early into any experiment, and the reforms that we are seeing in the criminal justice system are incredibly profound. In my time as a public defender, I still recall the number one question I was ever asked by a client was, Ms. Perez, can you help me get a job? And my incredible heartache at that time in recognizing that I was looking at someone who was in almost all circumstances, really ill-equipped to compete in our local economy, often many, many impediments such that are difficult to even articulate. And so my answer was almost always heartbreakingly no, that I could not. And as I stand here today, I look at a system that has undergone massive and major reform in the last few years. The conversations that are taking place are ones that are focused on rehabilitation, work skills, housing, and I feel a sense of hopefulness about the system that I simply never felt before.
You get a unique perspective on this because you not only have the local county perspective, but you also see what's happening in other counties through your role on the state board. How is Kern County faring?
You know, Kern County has had massive changes, and we are doing some cutting-edge programs here locally that simply were never considered on the table or even a possibility before. We have instituted in our local jail here a kiosk that connects in-custody clients directly, both in a private and dignified manner, over to child support services, and we have very compassionate and assertive folks on the other end of that kiosk that are helping in-custody clients think about how to connect with their children, how to make very minimal payments in order to get their licenses released or holds on their licenses, rather. And this is all done in a private, dignified manner within the jail cell. And so that is remarkable. We are the only ones to do this in the state of California, and we are, you know, leading the charge in that regard and connecting the dots. There are many, many impediments, but we know that when we bring services to people, most people really, really want to do the right thing and feel responsible about their obligations and duties. And if we can remove some of those barriers and impediments, we see major, major progress.
A big focus of a lot of these efforts is not only trying to reduce the prison population and save money and change a lot of things, but also reducing the recidivism rate. How do you see that working, and how do you, there's all kinds of different programs out there. How do you determine what actually works?
Part of what's so exciting about what's happening in Kern County and in multiple counties throughout California, we see it in Fresno as well as Santa Barbara, is a partnership with the Pew MacArthur Foundation that is helping us conduct cost-benefit analyses, if you will, on programs that we have in place, future programs that we're considering, and how we can think about real efficacy in terms of investment of taxpayer dollars, the evidence-based programs, if you will, how we can implement the programs that are going to work, that are a good investment on the taxpayer dollar. They're going to give us the kind of returns not only in savings to the criminal justice system, but in improvements in human capital, improvements in the quality of life for people that have been mired in the criminal justice system. And so we have been very, very, very blessed to have the partnership of Pew MacArthur. I know Fresno is one of the other participating counties, are four in California, and we are expanding across the state to look, take a real close and hard look at current programming, future programming. It's got to be evidence-based. It's got to be efficient for the taxpayer and also improve the lives of people that we know so desperately want to get out of that system. So whereas, you know, 5-10 years ago, programming in the jails wasn't even a consideration, we have advanced so quickly to now look at programs in their efficacy, both in the way they improve quality of life, reunite families, get people into, you know, competition within the local economy, and then, of course, you know, do this effectively in a way that makes sense not only locally but for the state of California. So I am very excited about that. That is major progress, and it really has indicated the level of partnership that is taking place at the local level as well as the state level to ensure that we are investing in the right kind of programming and that everyone, you know, all hands on deck for this.
Do you see a real sea change happening here in the world of criminal justice reform? It seems like even on the national level, you have some degree of bipartisan consensus that this is something that needs to be addressed, which seems like one of the few issues that there's bipartisan agreement on, including in Sacramento. You have people looking at other changes along these lines. Yet Kern County and really the whole San Joaquin Valley is still very much a law and order type, we need to be tough on crime place. At least that is in large part the sentiment amongst a large part of the public. Do you see a sea change happening there on this issue? And what is the mood like in the public in receiving these sorts of changes?
Well, as I stated earlier, the changes and reforms are more profound than we have ever considered or seen before. So there are always growing pains in that process. Improving a system, any entity in this state and locally should always be our goal. And so improving a system that has proven to be costly and not improve individual lives the way that you and I know that is so important, and I do believe resonates with every American and certainly Kern County folks, that it is a very complicated web of networks and factors. But what I do know is public safety remains high on the priority of folks in Kern County, the Valley, the state of California, an absolute certainty. But what is amazing is to see that so much opinion is shifting in terms of what does it really take to keep a public, to keep a community safe? Does it mean we continue to do business as usual, continue to a very costly system that is not giving us the kind of results that we all would like to see? Or should we think a little differently about the way in which an individual can become safer, can be a law-abiding citizen under circumstances by which they have some services, some opportunities, skill sets, closing those gaps? Can that actually lead to a safer community? So I think certainly it is always first and foremost on the hearts and minds of your citizenry to prioritize public safety. That is always going to be the case. But the methodology as to how we get to a safer community is really shifting. And that's what's exciting for me, because to see my local probation officers, to see my own sheriff, really at the forefront of talking about mental health services in the jail, about shifting programming, about providing these kind of services. We're certainly not where we need to be. We have a long way to go, but the fact that the conversation is happening and it's happening in a meaningful way and we're seeing the shift means that folks are starting to say, okay, business as usual didn't give us the kind of results we want. Public safety, absolute priority, but maybe there are better, cheaper ways to get there. And we can do it with improving quality of life for the entire community so that no one is left out of, their piece of the American pie.
We're talking with Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez today on Valley Edition about criminal justice reform and other issues. At the same time, we're dealing with Proposition 47 and the changes there with sentencing reform. You also have the continued legacy of realignment. Counties have been forced to take on a bigger burden of those prisoners who in one time were in state custody and in state prisons. In many cases, county facilities weren't designed to hold prisoners for the long term, as they are in some cases now. How is Kern County adapting to realignment?
I'll tell you, it has been an amazing process. I have been a member of the Community Corrections Partnership for several years now as a member of the Board of Supervisors, extended to the member, a member of the Community Corrections Partnership. Every county has them per realignment. And this is a compilation of all of the criminal justice leaders of a community. It is the police chief, your county sheriff, your head of probation, your head of mental health services, et cetera, et cetera. And what we have seen here locally is a dramatic shift in the investment of funds. We, of course, have to equip our law enforcement to deal with the public safety issues, but we see a bigger and larger percentage of monies going to community-based organizations to build capacity, to be able to determine which evidence-based programs are really going to work best for your local community, and how do we really tweak those programs so that they meet and suit the unique needs of a community. Kern County has gone full steam in this regard. We have a really forward-thinking probation director named T.R. Miracle, who's done a fantastic job of really mastering the evidence-based methodology. He's really dug into it very deep and meaningfully. He's a very intelligent individual, and he's really helped the CCP understand the importance of the proper profiling of an individual that is before you. Not everybody is the same, and not everybody's going to react the same way to the same kind of programming. So properly profiling based on evidence-based profiling and methodology is so critical. We've embraced that in Kern. So many other places in the state have embraced that in full recognition that we simply can do better. We can do better than what we've done before, that the system is very costly in its current form, and that we've got to find more efficient ways to deliver those services and improve public safety while improving quality of life. So Kern County has gone full steam ahead with advancing that methodology and acknowledging that, you know, perhaps there are better ways to do business.
Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood is an independently elected official. He doesn't work for the Board of Supervisors, but certainly the supervisors have a role to play when it comes to law enforcement. I want to get your thoughts on another issue that's related to law enforcement and criminal justice, and it's one that got national, even international, attention late last year. The British newspaper The Guardian did an extensive report on law enforcement practices in Kern County, both the Sheriff's Department, also Bakersfield PD and other agencies. What was your reaction to that report and the light that it cast on what is happening with the use of force in Kern County?
Well, certainly the Board of Supervisors works very closely with our sheriff in addressing employees that are not the best or model employee that you'd want within your operation. We know that that exists everywhere and at all levels. And certainly we have had issues within the Sheriff's Department like we have in any other department. I, for one, have been in close partnership with our sheriff as we have looked at many ways to improve the condition, morale, and accountability of our own Sheriff's Department. Our sheriff has greatly pushed issues of random drug testing, things that we are moving very quickly on to ensure that the accountability is as high as we possibly can have it, and that we are still working in conjunction with our sheriff rather than, you know, really penalizing him for many people that simply are not under his direct control. I know that we have a sheriff that absolutely desires a model sheriff's department with his employees being people of integrity, being people that are, not reflecting poorly on the county of Kern. He has a lot of employees, some of which are simply not model employees. And he works quickly and rapidly to remove those folks. They do have rights. It is complicated. And there are many, many factors at play. But certainly we can do better than what we have done. And it is exciting for me to see a sheriff that is aggressively pursuing these kind of methods to rein in members of his department that are that have either gone rogue or that are not as accountable as they can be. But I have personally witnessed our sheriff do so. And even in closed session this week, we were had these discussions of the ways in which our sheriff can be creative and have the backing of the Board of Supervisors in a community that is very pro-law enforcement. He is really thinking creatively on ways to improve accountability and transparency within his department.
And ultimately, it's the county's purse strings that are on the line when it comes to any legal judgments or settlements that are out there. So there's also that factor, right?
That is exactly right. And these are such immensely complicated issues. Nobody wants to pay out millions of dollars. Donnie Youngblood does not want to be responsible for millions of dollars that are paid out of the county coffers. He takes that very seriously. It is very personal. But, you know, we have a culture in Kern County that has been, very, very assertive in its law enforcement practices for many, many decades. And so shifting that culture is, as you know, not something that happens overnight, but certainly one in which has to be an absolute priority. And I am, I'm proud of the work that we're doing and the efforts that we're taking, because it's not easy to shift a culture. And certainly issues are, immensely, immensely complicated. But I do believe we're making progress. I always would love to see progress happen sooner rather than later, but I do believe we're moving in the right direction.
Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez joining us today on Valley Edition. She is also a member of the Board of State and Community Corrections, which oversees a number of criminal justice-related issues, including implementation of the state's Proposition 47, the voter-approved law that recategorized certain drug and property-related crimes from felonies to misdemeanors last year. Supervisor Perez, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Stay with us. More of our program is on the way. We'll learn not just why the valley is sinking, but how much it's going to cost to fix all the damage that subsidence is causing. And where can you go this weekend to see a bald eagle? Just a short drive from Fresno. That's all coming up in the second half of Valley Edition here on FM 89.
A lot is happening in our world today, across the nation, in our communities and neighborhoods. Valley Public Radio is in the midst of great change, preparing to relocate to the Technology Park in Clovis, California. This is Miriam Stepanian, and I'm thrilled to report we have exceeded the $200,000 James Irvine Challenge Grant. I thank each of you for your generosity in helping us cross the finish line. Outstanding collaboration. Our engaged board of directors, our talented staff, our passionate volunteers, and our community partners, and you, the listener. You are amazing. Congratulations. The next challenge is to meet the $1 million goal required for the building code upgrades. We met the Irvine Challenge, and we can meet this goal. Join us online at kvpr.org or call us at 1-800-275-0764. Wishing you the best for the new year.
And all things considered, story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock on Valley Public Radio.
Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. Former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has added fuel to a simmering debate over climate change. Schwarzenegger said recently that California's economy has not suffered from ambitious clean energy rules it's adopted over the past decade to fight climate change. Capital Public Radio's PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols investigated the claim and found there's plenty of debate, but not enough evidence yet to give it a rating.
Nearly 10 years ago, then-Governor Schwarzenegger signed into law a landmark bill to slash the state's carbon emissions. It was hailed by supporters as the start of California's clean energy future, one that would bring a wave of clean tech jobs to the state. At the time, critics said it would drive up energy costs and cripple the state's economy. On the day the landmark law was signed in 2006, Jack Stewart of the California Manufacturers and Technology Association predicted it would be painful.
Every time you add a new cost to doing business in California, there's somebody right on the edge who's ready to fall over. And as we implement these regulations, that's something we're going to keep in the front of our minds.
Flash forward to last month's Paris Climate Change Conference. That's where Schwarzenegger, in the muscle-bound movie star's grandiose style, touted California's bold clean energy experiment.
We flexed our muscles and we created action and we made a commitment to reduce our greenhouse gases by 25% by the year 2020 and 85% by the year 2050.
That same week, Schwarzenegger said in a widely circulated Facebook post that, quote, a clean energy future is a wise investment and anyone who tells you otherwise is either wrong or lying. He added, quote, we were an early adopter of a clean energy future. Our economy has not suffered. It's this point about the economy not suffering because of these rules that remains hotly debated. It inspired us to do a fact check. We spoke with several top economists who say there's just not enough data to evaluate whether the clean energy laws have helped or hurt California's bottom line. They say no one has produced an independent and rigorous study of the overall economic effect. Here's Severin Borenstein, an energy economist at UC Berkeley.
The statement that our economy has not suffered really does not have enough data behind it to either prove or disprove.
Some experts told us it may be years before we have an answer, because many of the carbon reduction mandates are still ramping up. So, for now, we won't rate Schwarzenegger's claim on our truthometer. A spokesman for the former governor could not point to definitive studies on the matter. At this point, there doesn't appear to be an easy answer. But, we wondered, what would we need to answer this question in the future? The experts say you'd start with tracking the price of electricity in California. You'd watch to see how fast carbon emissions are dropping. Then you take a close look at all the jobs truly lost and gained due to the new rules. Even then, they say, it might be impossible to get a clear resolution. Even without that, Stanford economist Charles Kolstad says all eyes are on California to see if its grand energy experiment works.
What's at stake is a demonstration that you can both reduce your carbon and not kill your economy. And it hasn't been shown anywhere in the world yet.
Kolstad says he's optimistic it will work, but he notes the evidence is just not available yet. Read the full version of all our fact checks at politifactcalifornia.com. At the state capitol, I'm Chris Nichols.
This is Valley Edition. California's prolonged drought has had many effects throughout the valley, but one of the most expensive and longest lasting could be happening right under your feet. Heavy dependence on historic, irreplaceable groundwater is causing something called subsidence, leading to parts of the valley sinking by as much as a foot a year. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with hydrologist Jim Borcher, who says it could cost more than $1 billion in damage.
Is the subsidence different than it's been before?
Well, it's surprised people for the second time now, or the third time. Yeah, the subsidence was first noticed in California in the Santa Clara Valley in the late 20s, early 30s, when they had about 100 square miles that had subsided by a foot or more, and 14 feet of subsidence in San Jose. So that was pretty shocking when that came out. And it cost them eventually $750 million or more to build levees to keep the bay from flooding subsided areas and to put levees and embankments around streams so they wouldn't flood and they could still discharge the water to the bay. They had to build larger sewers and additional sewers and pumping plants to get rid of the runoff from storms that had to now be pumped out of the low-lying areas. It could no longer flow by gravity to the bay because the bay would flow the other direction if they tried. And they had to elevate roads and bridges and build levees around the salt ponds. And many, many wells were destroyed when the ground collapsed and broke them. And some of these costs are not one-time costs. They're legacy costs, meaning that to run all these pumping plants to get rid of the storm runoff from the rainfall, they have to buy electricity. And so these costs continue in time indefinitely. Since then, we've had various environmental regulations requiring certain quantities of water to be present in stream channels to sustain fisheries and to keep the water quality, the salt content of the delta, in manageable limits so that the pumping plants can send the water south into the San Joaquin Valley in Southern California. And so the primarily agricultural interest and cities in the San Joaquin Valley had to, again, use more groundwater. And that's been referred to as an environmental drought. We also had the current drought, which has limited the availability of surface water tremendously. And, of course, groundwater, again, was relied on. And in some cases now we're putting wells down 3,000 feet. And these things are very expensive. Subsidence has started up in the last 10 years, some cases more than a foot a year. In two big areas of the San Joaquin Valley. We have a 2,700-square-mile area where we've had more than a foot of subsidence in the Tulare Basin, and further north in the central San Joaquin Valley, about 1,200 square miles with a foot of subsidence or more near El Nido. That's between Madera and Los Banos. So we had a lot of damage in the San Joaquin Valley over a period of decades, and we seem to forget about these problems when we're not using the groundwater system and groundwater levels recover, and then are shocked to find out that, gosh, it's back again when we have droughts and we're pumping. As the water level rises in the canals because of the subsidence pooling, it can overtop the canal embankments. It can erode the non-concrete parts of the embankments that are typically at the top edges of the canal embankments. And water levels have to be increased to a higher and higher height in order to get the flows that are needed downstream. Some of the canals may not run the right direction anymore and may have to install pumping facilities in order to bring the water to where it's needed. Canals damage wells. Subsidence damages wells, but when the land compacts and settles, it tugs on these well casings and can collapse them telescopically into themselves, and we see probably thousands of wells that have been damaged that way. And they're very expensive. The design life of a well might be 10 years, and it might cost $500,000 to put a new deep well in or more. We've seen that the lateral extent and depth of floodings increased. Pipelines and check dams and bridges have been submerged. Concrete canal linings have been buckled. We have declining freeboard on the canal embankments, on river levees, and in particular on flood bypass levees, which is very dangerous. If we do get an El Nino year that fills those flood bypasses and we have overtop levees, could be catastrophic flooding in parts of the San Joaquin Valley. And I have to say that although subsidence is very dramatic when you see a catastrophic effect, most of the time the entire area is subsiding at a rate that's not obvious to the naked eye. You can look out over the San Joaquin Valley and not realize anything's happening until water comes in and show you, a flood comes down and shows you where it's happened. So it's not like an earthquake or a forest fire where it's a sudden emergency and all kinds of resources are thrown at it to solve the problem. It's a subtle thing. It's a drastic thing. As a matter of fact, the San Joaquin Valley subsidence is probably the largest alteration of the Earth's surface by humankind. But nobody knew what was happening until they started having some very deleterious effects on getting the floodwaters out of the area. So it's kind of a sneaky problem, or science problem.
In
San Joaquin Valley, we think, I've tried to put together the various estimates of damage, and it looks like we're talking in more than $1 billion in damage to canals and roads and pipelines, condemned lands, irrigation networks and pipes, and the reduced carrying capacity of canals and sedimentation in flood channels. Where flood channels sag, the gradient steepens of the channel upstream, and sediment is eroded and deposited in the pool. So there's a sand removal process that needs to go on and a levee raising process that needs to go on. If the rivers were to flood, if the flood channel levees go, in this particular reach of the river restoration, there are developed areas, schools, and other facilities that would be inundated.
And you sort of answered this question, but if we get this El Nino, it's not going to reinflate the valley?
No, it isn't. No, matter of fact, parts of the valley and other places in the United States that have been heavily developed, like, say, the High Plains Aquifer in the Midwest, are really pumping water that recharged thousands of years ago. Maybe more than that. So they call it fossil water. So just because we get a few years of rain and recharge, we're not gonna refill the aquifer to the extent it was before the subsidence. And the biggest change, other than the fact that it takes a long time for some recharge to get to the deep aquifers, is that you're never gonna get the water back into the clays. It's like water in the clays is called water of compaction. When it comes out, it can't go back in. So it's like an inheritance, a box of gold that's buried in the backyard. Its value can't, if you take some out, you can't put any back in there. And if you do take it out, you better have a real good plan and you better really need it because it's a one-time resource. And you can say that in California we haven't planned well for the use of that water of compaction. And what we're looking at is the effect of that with these legacy problems of subsidence.
Yeah, that seems to be, aside from bridges, the biggest concern you've talked about is how California is heavily engineered how we move water around the state, and that would be the most expensive impact from the subsidence.
The canal networks themselves and the public canals were another big cost. We've talked about those, but the private canals, the irrigation district canals, the water agency canals, those costs are not really itemized in the published literature and oftentimes aren't accounted for separately outside of normal operation and maintenance budgets. They'll just be handled by the O&M staff at a water agency, and they'll raise their levees or they'll concrete up an area to keep erosion from happening without having separate accounting for the effects of subsidence. And the same thing goes for roads. If you look at the county highway departments or the Caltrans maintenance operations, subsidence is not listed as a cause of road damage, and it likely has some effects. We know that several of the roads have subsided 10 feet. These roads across the valley, Route 152 up near El Nido, has had over the years many feet of subsidence and probably some repairs associated with that.
Yeah, and to your point, it will make it much more expensive, not just in repairing and raising canals, but I mean potentially having to install pumps that you then have to pay for their foreseeable future. Just make it a lot more expensive to move water. It's a weird conundrum.
And it's even weirder when you think that, for instance, there are other causes of subsidence, like the oxidation of peat deposits, old organic swampy material, and the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. That area is farmed. They pump the groundwater out of the islands on the delta, and the peat oxidizes, and the land surface drops, in some cases more than 20 feet. Now, if we have an earthquake during a high tide or associated with global sea level rise, it'll flood those islands. If it floods those islands, salt water will come in from the bay and will increase the salinity so much at the pumping plants that they can't send water south in the California aqueduct because it's too salty. So in that case, the subsidence in the delta will actually cause more subsidence in the San Joaquin Valley, where everyone will have to pump to make up the difference in the water they're not getting from the delta. So it is a vicious circle. And the difficult thing is, what do you blame? Do you blame the droughts? Do you blame environmental regulations that say water has to stay in the streams? Do you blame the cities and ag interests that pump groundwater? And it's all connected. You know, you can't just point the finger at one group and say, you're causing this.
But it is exacerbated by the drought now.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the ag interests, the farmers, are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. They're fallowing their land because they don't have the water to put on their crops. And the only water they do have is in the groundwater, and that just makes the system worse as subsidence happens. It's a tough problem, and everybody's hoping that this new Sustainable Groundwater Management Act will help organize and coordinate surface and groundwater use so that the system becomes sustainable by 2040. We're really hopeful that'll work. It's a difficult problem when you see a lot of these high water use crops that are planted out there in places that used to be rangeland or row crops.
That was hydrologist Jim Borcher talking with Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess about the problems with subsidence in the San Joaquin Valley, a problem that he says could cause up to $1 billion in infrastructure damage. This is Valley Edition. Winter might be a cold and wet time of the year here in Central California, but it's also a great time to get outside and enjoy nature. And with the High Sierra covered in snow, hikers turn to the foothills this time of year. Here to tell us more about some of the outdoor opportunities that Valley residents can take advantage of in January, we have two guests with us on the phone. State Park Ranger Mark DeLeon at Millerton Lake. He leads the Bald Eagle hikes and boat tours at the reservoir. And Rosanna Ruiz, Education and Outreach Director with the Sierra Foothill Conservancy. They're launching this season with hikes to the historic Tabletop Mountains along the foothills in Madera and Fresno counties. Mark, I want to start with you. Bald eagles just nearby Fresno? A lot of people would be surprised to hear that that's actually even a possibility.
Yeah, it is. It's very surprising for our Valley residents. These birds have been visiting us here at Millerton Lake for years, if not hundreds of years. So this program has been established. It started in the mid-80s here at Millerton Lake. Our resident biologist, Mike Smith, started the program with a couple of rangers in the mid-80s, and people used to come out just on our flat pontoon boat with their lawn chairs. It's now established into a really good program where we've got a 30-foot pontoon boat with 25 seats for Valley residents to come out and enjoy the birds. Typically on weekends, we'll see anywhere from 5 to 10 birds out here.
So tell me a little more about this population of bald eagles that calls Millerton home. Or, in fact, do they call Millerton home? Or are they just passing through on a regular basis?
Well, we call them our neighbors. We call them, you know, they're Valley residents for this time period. So what happens is back in the 90s, our biologists working with Santa Cruz area biologists in with Mike Smith, they put a telemetry radio. They banded these birds and actually tracked their flights. So initially we thought our birds here at Millerton were visiting from maybe the upper reaches of the eastern, the western coast there of our nation. It turns out they were coming from the northern central territories of Canada near the Great Slave Lake, way north of here. So if you can imagine how far that is. And we tracked them in those regions. And what our biologists were telling us here is that basically, you know, in the winter time, those lakes freeze over. So we don't know exactly why. We think for, of course, resources, for food resources, that those birds visit us here starting in the fall, and they stay all the way through spring. We have seen birds in the spring and summer months here, but not in great numbers. But, you know, the more numbers we see are in the fall and winter months. So we do call them our we don't know if we have birds that stay here year-round. We know that they stay longer into the warmer months. But right now, I mean, they are here.
Any tips for spotting one of these eagles on a hike or if people go on this boat tour? Is there gear that they have to bring? Can you see them with the naked eye, or do you bring a telescope, binoculars? Well, how does that work?
Yeah, most of the time, you know, you can see them with the naked eye. You do have to train your eye. Usually people say, oh, I could probably spot the, you know, the white head of the bald eagle there quite easily. However, that's not the case. They do blend in very well in the terrain. Once you kind of train your eye to what you're looking for, and we do talk about that on these boat tours, it's actually pretty easy to spot them. But we do provide binoculars, so there are binoculars out on the boat, so you're able to use those. And if you want to bring your own binoculars and camera, you're more than welcome to do that.
So when's the next tour coming up?
So we have tours. They actually started already. So every weekend, starting in January and February and the first weekend in March, Saturday and Sundays, they start at 8 a.m., and we meet at the courthouse here at Millerton Lake on the South Shore.
That's the old historic courthouse that is the old Millerton courthouse that was rebuilt up there by Fryant Dam, right?
Yes, that is correct. So that's where the tour starts. You come in, you'll meet the ranger, what ranger is assigned on the tour that day. You will meet our resident biologist, Mike Smith, who is on most of the tours. And we go through a slideshow presentation of the birds that are here. Most of the birds that you will see in that slideshow were, you know, photographed here on the lake. You'll then get on a boat, and we go looking for eagles. So it's not a structured tour per se when you get on the boat and you go to certain points. We just start scanning the lake in the shoreline and surrounding areas and see if we could find birds. And we see a bird, we'll go to it and get pictures, and hopefully we get some good shots, you know.
And if people want a phone number or more information about this, how can they contact you?
Oh, yeah, that's very easy. So the best time to contact is Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., and you can reach us at area code 559-822-2332, and that's the office here at Millerton Lake.
Great. And speaking of other opportunities out there, I want to bring Rosanna Ruiz now into the equation. She is with the Sierra Foothill Conservancy. They're launching their season of hikes with Mackenzie Tabletop and other areas throughout the foothills. In fact, some areas you can probably spot some bald eagles as well. Rosanna, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tell me about what tours and hikes you have coming up with this Foothill Conservancy. We're talking about, in some cases, the same general vicinity as Millerton Lake along the San Joaquin River. Am I correct?
Actually, we do have some hikes that have views overlooking the San Joaquin River, so there's a potential that you could see those bald eagles. But oftentimes we see the golden eagles, as we do have nesting pair on one of our cliff faces, so that's pretty exciting.
So what hikes? What hikes do you have coming up?
The hikes that we have coming up, actually, in the next few weeks, we have one on our Feingold Creek, which is in Madera, and then we have several on the Mackenzie Preserve, which include the Tabletop hike, and on the Black Mountain Summit, which is in Toll House, and then also our Stockton Creek Preserve in the Mariposa area.
Now, I want to take a step back here. You mentioned the Mackenzie Tabletop. A lot of people who have been in the valley their whole lives probably know what you're talking about, but someone who might be new to the area is saying they're hiking on top of a table. What is this? We're talking about what, a geologic feature here?
Correct. Very unique, very amazing to actually go up there and see the formation. Tables are basalt, and it's actually not flat as you would think of a table, but it is very rocky.
So this is a table-like mountain out near the San Joaquin River, and this is land that the Foothill Conservancy borrows, it owns. How does that work?
Some of the tabletops, not all of them, are actually located on our Mackenzie Preserve. So we actually own that preserve, which is just under 3,000 acres. So we do have access to particular areas of the tabletops.
Right. So you're preserving that land for future generations and things. If somebody wants to go on a hike, what should they be prepared for? Are these especially strenuous, or is it something that more of a novice hiker could take on?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually have an events calendar on the website, and when you click on the various hikes, it will actually tell you what to expect. Is it a strenuous hike? Is it for advanced hikers only? Are you doing something easy to moderate, steep slopes, rugged? Yeah, so we have really a variety of hikes available.
Great. And if people want more information, your website and phone number and all of that.
Yes, so our website is www.sierrafoothill.org, and you can be reached at area code 559-855-3473 in Prather or 209-742-5556 in Mariposa.
It's a great opportunity to get outside and enjoy the beauty of our Central California region. Rosanna Ruiz with the Sierra Foothill Conservancy and State Park Ranger Mark DeLeon with the Millerton Lake Bald Eagle Tours. Thanks to both of you for joining us. That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, send us your thoughts and comments. Email us talk@kvpr.org or tweet us at kvpr. And at Valley Edition, you can find our podcast, subscribe to it online, find the Valley Edition page on our website at kvpr.org. And a special programming note tonight, our normal 7 p.m. rebroadcast of Valley Edition will happen at 8 tonight, following the President's State of the Union address. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment, Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.